Hello, Capital Region. This is the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York. I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. Today, we start out with an update on the community choice aggregation effort for electricity here in the Capital District.
And then, for our weekly piece segment, we talk with Joe Lombardo about Biden and his international foreign policy plans.
And later on, our Roman labor correspondent, Willie Terry, hosts a segment on Black workers in a time of COVID.
After that, we have a segment on the challenges college students have during the pandemic.
And finally, we're joined by Casey Carey Horanick of the Ponca tribe in Oklahoma to discuss why Congress must address plastic pollution and environmental injustice in the next stimulus bill. But first, news headlines.
A Times Union analyst of police disciplinary records found that many police departments handled even serious misconduct allegations with counseling memos that are kept on file for a short period of time before being expunged from the officer's personal files. Removing the memos also makes it harder for the public to find them through Freedom of Information requests.
With four more COVID deaths on Tuesday, the Capital Region has surpassed 1,000 official deaths from the coronavirus. More than half the deaths have been linked to long-term care health facilities. Albany County, with 342, has accounted for more than a third of the deaths in the Capital Region. Almost half of the deaths have occurred since the start of 2021. Statewide, 109 people died from COVID on Tuesday.
The Gazette reports that the Nurses Union at Albany Medical Center has gone public with its concern about the hospital's cancer unit and the several dozen COVID cases that have originated there. The nurses said that poor management has led to more than 50 infections and one death and prompted the state health department to close down the unit.
The Times Union reports that four Rensselaer County men who wore body armor and carried police batons while walking through the Troy's peaceful Black Lives Matter protest last June pled guilty in city court to a variety of charges. They were given small fines and a conditional discharge. A fifth defendant, a soldier, still faces felony charges over the possession of a weapon. The five men have ties to a regional militia group, the New England Minutemen.
The issue of whether Schenectady Civilian Police Review Board should have different rules or enhanced powers as part of the police accountability reforms were postponed Tuesday after some of the proposals by Public Safety Committee Chairwoman Marion Porterfield got significant pushback, according to the Daily Gazette. The city's attorney will review whether the board members should be required to sign confidentiality agreements and whether the review board should know the names of the officers whom they were reviewing complaints about.
Montgomery County-based Beechnut Nutrition is the target of class action lawsuits filed over potentially dangerous heavy metals in the baby food it makes. According to the Gazette, Beechnut and six other baby food manufacturers were the subject of a critical congressional report released February 4th. The presence of arsenic, cadmium, lead, and mercury in baby food made by Beechnut, Campbell, Gerber, Hain's Celestial, Nurture, Sprout Foods, and Walmart posed serious health problems.
The record reports that Rensselaer County is ready to expand a country mass vaccination site and partner with the state to deliver vaccines on a county and regional basis. The county, in partnership with Hudson Valley Community College, has distributed 650 vaccines in a single day, a number which the county says it could double.
And that's it for news headlines.
And now we start off today's show by talking to Mark Dunley. Hello, Mark. And we're talking today about the what is the status of the community choice aggregation in the Capital District, Mark? Can you explain that? And also, can you explain what CAA is?
Sure. We've had a couple of guests on in the past related to community choice aggregation. Community choice aggregation is when municipalities band together to collectively buy electricity for the residents of their community. It's quite prevalent out on the West Coast, particularly California, where a majority of the residents of the state of California get their electricity through CCA. But it's only been in New York State for about 3 years. There's probably maybe about a half a dozen CCAs that have been set up right now. And, you know, the idea is if, you know, say, well, in the Capital District, we've had 13 municipalities agree to form a CCA. I forget the exact number, but it's probably around 80,000, 90,000 households. So the idea is if you go out together and say, listen, we want a two-year contract to provide electricity to, you know, 90,000 residential customers in our 13 municipalities, you know, what price we can get, can we get? Often because you're doing so many households, you can get a bit of a discount. You probably get a bigger discount when you buy 100% renewable energy compared to what, say, you or I as an individual household would have to pay if we try to just buy that individually. And then what happens is that in the 13 municipalities, if a particular residential customer doesn't want to be part of the CCA, they can opt out. Normally, you want the default sort of electricity package to be the green package, the renewable package.
That's what I wanted to ask you, Mark, because it means like you sort of join it. It's almost like a co-op, right?
Is it kind of a deal? It is similar to the concept of a co-op.
And then do we get a guaranteed of environmentally friendly workings on getting our energy from environmentally friendly functions?
Well, yes, you can get that. You can say, you know, we want to buy the electricity only from, you know, hydro and wind and solar. Often what the CCA does, it has a couple of different options. So one of the options we call the brown option is more just similar to what the local utility provides, but because you're providing a, you know, 80,000 households at once, you hope you can get a cheaper rate. But then also over time, you're hoping that the CCA, you know, begins to focus more on what type of energy system do we want to create, say here in the Capital District. And so you can say, well, we want to add on community solar farms as part of the package, or we want to encourage the development of a wind farm, or we're going to offer various type of discounts to the local residents if they put solar on their own roof, or if they do, you know, energy retrofits. I mean, the idea is once you begin to control your energy, you can expand the type of services you're provided.
I noticed that it was quite successful. At least I had the feeling it was last year in the Capital District. Is it? And how is Troy? Is Troy part of this as well?
Well, we were successful in getting a lot of communities to agree. You mentioned Troy, Albany, Schenectady, the big ones. There's 13 of them, Bethlehem, Kinderhook, Glen Falls, Saratoga. The problem was it hasn't actually kicked off. And energy prices for the fossil fuel companies have been very volatile because the fossil fuel industry has gone through this big upheaval. And so prices, you know, sort of good for the customers, have dropped down lower than the traditional pattern. And so people were a little bit concerned that if they went out for a bid, they couldn't guarantee that the prices would be lower. In many cases, they would be, but they couldn't guarantee that. I kind of disagreed that they sort of held off because of that, I would have moved ahead because I think the real advantage is to promote renewable energy. But in communities where there's a lot of low-income residents, particularly like Albany and Schenectady, I think they were a little bit more concerned about the price impact. And then also with COVID, you know, the towns and the cities were a little bit nervous about taking on a new project. It seemed like it was going to be a simple thing to do, following the lead of others. Suddenly with the upheaval in the energy market, they were like, you know, this is going to require more brain power. And right now we're devoting a lot of our brain power, you know, to trying to deal with the COVID situation. Other CCAs in the state, a little bit further along, they did not pause, but the Capital District did pause, and they also weren't particularly happy with the bid that was put out. So we're sort of in a transitional period at this moment. And Troy, you know, they're thinking of actually sort of taking a step out of the CCA because for various reasons, and they're not, I think, perhaps not entirely sold on the particular company that was selected to sort of run the program. And they're going potentially in a different direction. And they may look at, as some of the CCAs have done, they may look at initially going with community solar. So just giving the people the option to buy solar. And if you buy in solar through a community solar program, you're sort of guaranteed a 10% discount on your bill. So that, you know, reduces the risk that you're going to be paying more money. And then hopefully once they've done the community solar, you know, they may, you know, join back with the larger package.
So is this sort of compatible with what I need to know is when you go with the CCA, does it, the most important thing, is it reducing your cost for energy, or is the most important thing that you're using renewable energy, which, or is it a balance between the two?
Well, it's a balance between the two. And I was one of the people who, you know, started the concept of a CCA in the Capital District. And my focus, and I think most of the initial people's focus, was on climate change. And that this is a way that local communities could take control away of the electricity supply from, say, National Grid. National Grid would still be responsible for running the wires. They'd still be sending you the bill. But basically, they would be doing the customer service part of the equation, whereas the CCA would be doing the decision-making on who to purchase electricity from. And it was a way, and it was actually very heavily promoted by Governor Cuomo and the Public Service Commission and state regulators, that this was a good way to promote renewable energy. The other thing that sort of occurred, which is, once again, sort of a mixed situation, is that the state has significantly increased the requirements that utilities like National Grid buy renewable energy, which is really good. The problem is that the state has been torturously slow in developing renewable energy. 18 years after Governor Pataki first started us on the path of building more renewable energy, we've only managed to add an extra 5% coming from wind and solar. And wow. A big problem has been, is really often will take 10 years to be able to get permission to build, you know, a large scale, utility scale wind or solar. To the governor's credit, he is recognized as a problem, and he passed changes in the law 2 years ago or last year that he hopes will reduce that permit time from 10 years down to 2 years. But the problem is we're still, you know, in another year or two before we begin to see more of these renewable energy comes online. And with the utility companies being required to now buy renewable energy as well, and the CCA is trying to bore renewable, when the supply doesn't increase, but the demand increases, then prices will go up. So, you know, part of the problem is the price of renewable energy has been going up, and then you've had this very up and down price on the fossil fuels. And that's another reason that the, you know, companies have given pause.
Well, we've only got a couple minutes left, or a couple, I think about a minute or so left. So where do we go from here? How can we, as a community, support more CCAs?
Well, I mean, I think people need to talk to their local officials, particularly if you're in one of these 13 towns, and to say, we want to move ahead with the CCA. Yes, we want lower prices if possible, but we want to get more renewable energy. We want particularly to get cheaper renewable energy that we can get through privately. We want you to start looking at how do you build more community solar? Can you look at other, you know, Marbletown, which is down the Hudson Valley, is really just trying to work now with individual homeowners so they can upgrade, you know, energy retrofit their homes, put in air heat pumps and other measures and save money. We do have a website, but if you basically the Capital District Community Energy is sort of the local coalition of groups that's been set put together to work on this. So you can check us out on Facebook and on web pages. And then in Troy, you know, talk to Anasha Cummins, a city council member. He seems to be the one that's working hardest to make this happen.
Great. Mark, thanks so very, very much. You're a world of information when it comes to the CCAs and a lot of other stuff, too. We talked here, Mark, you spoke the other day with Joe Lombardo from Del Mar, who is one of the national co-chairs of the United Nations Anti-War Coalition, about the Biden administration's plans. Here we go.
We're talking with Joe Lombardo, longtime peace activist from the Del Mar area, had been involved with Bethlehem Neighbor for Peace. We're particularly talking with him in his role as co-chair of the United National Anti-War Coalition. Joe, why don't you give us a brief introduction to UNAC and maybe some of the upcoming priorities now that, you know, President Biden the new commander in chief.
Well, UNAC is a coalition of anti-war and social justice groups. It was actually started in 2010 right here in Albany at a very large conference of about 800 people. And one of the reasons it was started was because we saw the anti-war movement go hide kind of after the Obama administration, and we don't want to see it again happening with the Biden administration. Sometimes it's easier for some people to fight against wars when there's a Republican administration, not a Democratic administration. But the present Democratic administration has continued with the policies of the previous Republican administration, so it's very important that we keep up our activity. We're doing a number of things around Afghanistan, Iraq, Syria, Yemen. Just had days of protest on Yemen on the 25th of January, and many other issues. Today, one of the big issues that's starting to rise up is the mass upsurge in Haiti, which you're not hearing very much about on the U.S. media.
Now, one of the things that, me being a little naive, surprised me a bit was that the president intends to continue to recognize the illegitimate alternative, you know, coup d'etat government of Venezuela. But I also understand that he's having some problems with Ecuador.
Well, yeah, there was a progressive government in Ecuador that actually gave Julian Assange refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in London. And then that was replaced by someone who represented himself as a progressive, a guy named Lenin Moreno, and turned out to be a real big puppet of the United States and followed all of the dictates of the United States. And they now have voted him out. His person, the right-wing person, came in far distant second to two progressive candidates that are running. And the United States did everything they could to work with him to get him elected, to try to suppress the vote in Ecuador, as they do often here in the United States. And so hopefully things are going to turn up in Ecuador, but the United States is doing what it can to keep in this right-wing government.
And you mentioned Haiti. What's been going on with Haiti?
Well, there's another interim government in Haiti who has been very right-wing, has been sponsoring death squads and gangs that have been suppressing people's movement, which has been on the rise quite a lot in Haiti. And his term is up. And so they decided to have elections. He decided not to have elections. He said his term is not up and he's not going to give it up. The Supreme Court in Haiti said, yes, your term is up, and actually appointed an interim president to take his place. And he's refused to step down. He's increased the repression. The United States is backing him to the hilt. And the masses have come out in the streets in gigantic numbers. You're just not hearing about it in the U.S. media. So the anti-war movement is starting to back the masses in the streets and calling for a free democratic election in Haiti and to get rid of the U.S. puppet government that exists there right now.
Now, one of the few, I guess, I'm sure it's flawed, but, you know, somewhat bright spots of the Obama Biden administration in terms of foreign policy was at least coming to some agreement with Iran on nuclear and other stuff, which, you know, got thrown out by Trump. You know, how has Biden reacted to Iran now that he's back in power?
Unfortunately, he seems to be going along with what Trump did and not with what his administration as the vice president under Obama had done. As you know, Trump unilaterally withdrew from the agreement. For a long time, Iran kept with its part of the agreement, even though the U.S. withdrew and imposed incredibly harsh sanctions on Iran, including not allowing medicine during this pandemic. But Biden, instead of going back to the terms of the agreement and saying, okay, let's reestablish it, he says, well, to Iran, you got to go back to the terms of the agreement first, and we're not going to lift the sanctions. Once you do, we will renegotiate those terms. And we want certain concessions. We want not just you to get rid of any nuclear program, even though they claim their nuclear program was just for nuclear energy, not for nuclear power. We want you also to get rid of the missiles. But the United States has been attacking Iran, and Israel has been attacking Iran, and its missiles are its defense. So they have said that's a bridge too far. And so it appears that the Biden administration is not going back to the agreement that was negotiated under Obama. Instead, he's sticking with the plan that was imposed by Trump.
Now, you know, a couple of things that Trump did was, you know, both create a space for us, and he's also moved the American embassy in Israel to Jerusalem. I guess Biden has at least opened up some communications with the Palestinian authorities. But, you know, what's going on with the Space Force and, you know, in the Middle East in general, particularly Israel and Palestine?
Well, the Space Force, the anti-war movement looked at that and it was a very terrible move. It brought the arms race up into space, and it's just increasing the arms race by doing that. So instead of moving back and stopping the Space Force, which was started under Trump, Biden has said he's going to keep the Space Force. So it's going to increase the arms race and bring it up into space. There are international treaties saying that you can't do that and that you can't put military equipment on the moon. You're not supposed to be using space for military reasons, but the United States is doing it and Biden is sticking with it. On Israel, Trump brought us in a terrible, terrible way. He said that that the Israelis can continue illegally to take over the land of the Palestinians. He moved the embassy, as you mentioned, to Jerusalem, which was, you know, Jerusalem is a shared city among various religions and various nationalities. It's not just the capital of Jerusalem, and that's what Israel wanted, and that's what he did. And of course, they made this incredibly terrible deal with some of the Arab countries to recognize Israel and basically abandon their support for the Palestinians. And we haven't had any real moves on the part of Biden to overcome any, to go back on any of these terrible moves that are done by Trump. Hopefully he will, but we haven't seen any of that yet. And it's turning out worse and worse for very many people. You know, more and more states are passing rules that you can't say anything negative about Israel. You can't support BDS. Abby Martin, a journalist, was denied the right to speak in Georgia and has a case in the Supreme Court because she has done a movie around the plight of the Palestinians. And so they discontinued her ability to speak at a university in Georgia. So she has a suit against that. So on many issues with the Palestinians, we're seeing any kind of mention of the Palestinians in a light of support or any kind of talk about the bad things that Israel has been doing to the Palestinians is actually being censored out of our entire ability to speak to the media or anything else right now. So,
So we've been talking with Joe Lombardo, United National Anti-War Coalition. In the last 15 seconds, Joe, if people want more information about UNAC, participate, how did they do that?
To unacpeace.org, UNACPEACE.org, and you'll find out the campaigns that the anti-war movement is doing, how to join with us, how to strengthen the anti-war movement. Thank you, Mark.
Thank you, Joe. And this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network. So one of the things Joe also mentioned was that UNAC has decided to open up its, I guess, monthly coordinating committee, conference calls, Zoom meetings to any of the peace activists. And one of the things they will be focusing on near term is the discussion, you know, what is the future direction of the anti-war movement here in the United States now that we have, a new president. And, you know, every Wednesday we do try to feature a peace segment.
So for those of you just turning in, I'm Andrea Cunliffe.
And I'm Mark Dunley. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network, WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Troy. Coming to you from the beautiful Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York.
And to learn more about the Hudson Mohawk Magazine program, you can listen online and how to learn how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media. Check us out online at mediasanctuary.org or get in touch with us through email at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. So now for our third segment this evening, Willie Terry, that's our wonderful Willie Terry, who hosts The Struggle Continues, a roundtable discussion on topics that impact the freedom struggles. Today's topic is part three of Black Workers in Time, in the Time of COVID. The panelists are David Walker, Leanne Van Dyke, Carlo Duflar, and Angel Martinez.
Now, here's something I know Carlos made the question. What lesson did the civil rights or the Black Power movement teach us about waging struggles, let's say, in a virus environment?
We have to recognize that it was the unions that played 1199, the United Auto Workers, and many other unions that fought. Remember the sanitation workers and Memphis, Tennessee in 1968, that they were struggling just to be recognized as a union when two people were crushed. Mm-hmm. They were crushed by that machine, and they wasn't. So the struggle always has been the labor union. We're fighting, we're struggling just for a better world, for better wages, for a better, health system that we don't have. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'll just say this, like somebody said to me, this is the richest country in the world, and why do we have so many people dying? And other countries in the world have been able to manage and control this virus that exists. And right. I mean, We have to study this. Mm-hmm. We have to study it.
Right. And I also think that, like when I went back in history, when they had that first pandemic, Black people wasn't getting the help needs met because of discrimination. Especially through the Jim Crow era, you know, we couldn't go into white hospitals, you know. So all those things and diseases and ailments we just had to live with. And when our parents migrated from the South to the North, you know, those things didn't go away. And, you know, and over a period of time, matter of fact, even in the North, we were having problems being discriminated in the health realm. You know, we didn't have doctors and a whole lot of things. So that even happened. So what I'm saying is that we, because of people dying from COVID, and they said it got a lot to do with preconditions, then those conditions were put on us historically. So that's what I'm trying to say. You see what I'm saying, Angel? Go ahead, Angel.
That's a great question. The pre-existing conditions are everything you've been talking about so far. Yeah. If you go back to Jim Crow, I mean, that's enough. We can go back to slavery. We can go back to indigenous genocide. These are just one genocidal act after another, and those are the pre-existing conditions. And we have yet to heal from it because we're still being harmed from it. We're still being harmed from it. I mean, that's why you have to... That's what's really key. But that's what we're fighting is. I mean, if you figure, when they do have medical procedures, they have forced sterilization against Puerto Rican women in the island, Black women in the southern United States, and now women at the border in the border jails being sterilized too. Mm-hmm. So this is the only medical procedure they'll actually pay and deliver on, but they won't even give you basic medical care for things that you can normally survive.
Right.
I mean, you know, if even the United Nations said a couple of years ago tropical disease has been coming back in full force, mm-hmm. where they thought they were eliminating them, that's a long way. And this is even way before the plague came in just now. This has been going on for several years now. Right. And of course, that makes certain forces upset, but we just got to keep pushing.
Right. And you know what? I was thinking, I said, even though this virus came around and a lot of people are dying, I said, well, you know, the condition we was in the condition of a virus, which was the virus of the system that we was fighting against to try to get right, you know, that was really killing us and keeping us down. And that played right. that played a part in terms of us. But I don't think the civil rights movement, you know, ever dealt with the question of any type of virus during that time. Right, Carlos? I don't think there was no virus or anything. It's just that...
What we were struggling for was a basic fundamental, which is a continuum of hundreds of years of violence and police brutality nationwide.
Mm-hmm. So what role should Black workers involved in the freedom struggles today play during this pandemic? What should we be doing today?
Tell the world about it, for one thing. We do have a lot of allies, and we need to fully realize that we're definitely not alone. We're definitely a key. Black working class needs to see what it has in common that is in solidarity with an international working class that really is hungry for that knowledge of what's going on here. Because when they know that, then they know how to agitate for us better. We saw piece of that when people around the world were marching after the murder of George Floyd. Mm-hmm. I mean, just people around the world, it triggered things that really said, wow, people are actually protesting over here. And most countries are like, well, do people protest anything? Well, they sure found out, and they went to the embassies to really make their mark, or just had their rallies, or got together and just really talked about it, going to Zoom meetings and just really talk about what the cause is. So,
if that little bit
triggered it, imagine what more we could do. How did what?
I said, how impactful was that march for George Floyd and the Black Lives Matter in the presidential election? Do you think that really was the cause of that?
Well,
getting rid of Trump.
I think for one thing, it really showed the flaws in this two-party system. I mean, people were voting for one because they didn't want the other, and that's something workers need to break away from totally. I think it did bring people to the polls, and that was it did help bring people along with the COVID, and that was needed. And it also showed how, you know, you don't have to vote. You don't have to vote in person. You can set it by mail. I mean, you could do it to a Dropbox. So you could vote safely as well as securely. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what it teaches us. So I think it really forced people to say, hey, wait a minute, we have to do something about it. Mm-hmm. We don't have to agree with everything, but we got to do something about it. But I hope that what it ends up creating, that we said that, you know, workers just need their own party. Just like you go in every other country, well, there's mm-hmm. a multiple party, and at least one that fights for our rights as workers and fights against the...
So, Colin, what do you think?
Pepper sprayed a 9-year-old girl and then handcuffed her. Mm-hmm. And everybody told us in the world. They said, this is disgusting. This is horrible. It's almost like being in Nazi Germany. Mm-hmm. But they're always claiming that they want to bring democracy all over the world. They're always telling somebody that. But doesn't practice. I remember what the late minister, Brother Minister Martin Shabazz said, that they make the victim look like he's the criminal, and the criminal look like he's the victim. Right. And this is one of the things that we have to study more than anything else. That's all I can say. I can share.
Mm-hmm. But and I was asking that question because I think that the whole movement for Black Lives had an impact on the election, because I think Trump probably would have won if it hadn't been for that movement building up people, you know, getting not just those, you know, the people who vote all the time, but it brought in new people, you know, new voters, new people who had never been involved in anything, and they saw that what they did to George Floyd, that was wrong, and they know that was wrong. They said nobody shouldn't put no knee on nobody for 8 minutes and kill them like that. So I think the whole Black Lives Matter movement moved this country, and I think the Biden administration is gonna owe a debt to the Black Lives Matter movement. And also to Black people, for voting for him in that Georgia primary where they won those two Senate races. Because if they hadn't voted for them two Senate races, then, you know, all that stuff that he's talking about now, he could never get it through. Not through the a Republican Senate. But And at the same time that that was going on, I mean, the COVID situation was here, you know. And we still got a lot of problems with that. And I think racism had played a lot into that, you know, what we just talked about, because of all the inequality is still happening. But I want to thank Angel Martinez and Carlos Dolfo for, you know, sticking this out.
And that was Willie Terry. He was also joined by David Walker and Leanne Van Dyke. And that was part three of Black Workers in Time of COVID. And you can find the entire segment on our podcast at mediasanctuary.org.
Sean McGarrity, a University of Albany junior at the Department of Atmospheric Sciences, talks with Media Sanctuary intern Alex Weinrich about the hardships students face with online learning.
As a student, do you know any way that Albany is giving you support through this pandemic and your online learning?
I know as a whole they have the Academic Help Center, but within my particular department, I know they provide tutoring services to help with my own classes within the major.
In what ways is online learning harder than in-person learning?
Not having the same level of human interaction really limits your ability to fully grasp onto the material we're learning. And I feel like it also makes interacting with other students, whether it be in the classroom or doing a hybrid or people who are online as well, makes it harder to interact with them and collaborate, as would be the case if we were all in an in-person setting.
So I understand you're in math courses. I know those can be tricky online. How complex has online learning made that?
I would say that it is definitely more difficult to an extent, asking questions to the professor and getting a clear, comprehensive answer can also be more tedious over Zoom. But with tutoring services provided, there is still an avenue one could take to still get an adequate education, at least in the math department.
Is there any specific advice you would give any professors to help students learn online?
Be aware that it can be awkward to reach out via Zoom or other electronic means. So be open to possibly having more one-on-one interactions outside of a live Zoom class session.
So there's been a large impact on students' mental health with the stress of COVID and the lack of social interaction. Are you able to focus on your studies with this?
I would say I'm still able to focus on my studies. It might be more difficult than it typically would be, since I'm not seeing friends and other students that I would typically see on the daily. But I try to keep a focus on what is still important in terms of my grades and assignments.
Do you personally, or do you know any other students who have been struggling mentally because of online learning?
I can't say it for myself, but I can assume that many people have a lack of social interaction can cause loneliness and stress just from the lack of human interaction, which I feel like is common for most people, not just students.
And how seriously do you think that this is affecting students' academics?
I feel like it could go both ways. In some ways, students might be doing better because they're in a remote setting and may have access to the internet, which in of itself could be an issue for integrity. But in other aspects, I do see how students can struggle not having the typical classroom setting in person and instead having to learn through pre-recorded videos or live Zoom feeds.
Personally, do you prefer live Zoom meetings, pre-recorded, or do you prefer learning on your own, and why?
I prefer live Zoom classes so you can still interact with your fellow students as well as the instructor, whether it be through texting in the group chat that is available through Zoom or just unmuting yourself. It just is the closest way to have a human interaction with each other.
In terms of your own personal stress and mental health, have you done anything self-help-wise, any form of self-care?
I have looked up online suggestions of how to deal with loneliness and isolation, specifically during the time of this pandemic, which have been published since the pandemic started. But I've also tried to fill my time with more productive hobbies and tasks to fill the time, as well as to connect with friends, whether it be through FaceTiming or texting or reaching out on social media. Things that can help ease the loneliness that will otherwise come about when you're just focusing on remote learning.
To my understanding, UAlbany has a counseling service. Have you ever thought of reaching out, or do you know anything specifically about this counseling service?
I have heard of it. It's called CAPS. I have reached out in the past, and it is available to any UAlbany student. It's offered through the university itself. Any discussion topic can be covered with those sessions, whether it be anxiety, depression, mental health problems.
I've heard some students say that they were referred elsewhere or just weren't too happy with how CAPS handled their situation. Do you have any experiences such as this, or do you know of any experiences such as this?
From my own experience, I thought my interaction with CAPS was okay, but I do know some people who have been referred outside of the system and have since found issue finding a good counselor or psychologist.
What message do you want to give the university about students learning online?
I think learning online is still a new experience for many of us students, even though this is our third semester dealing with it. I would tell the university to continue to communicate with your instructors and TAs and tutoring services to be more flexible in understanding of each student's possible background and lifestyle outside of academia and how that can influence both their performance in the classroom.
Do you think the university and professors have gotten better with online learning since the beginning of the pandemic last year?
I do think a good portion of the university staff have adapted well to the circumstances, whether it be with the technology or just the interaction with students. I do feel some of them are still lacking in their ability to properly teach online, or homework assignments online tend to still have a problem.
Do you have any instances of professors going above and beyond with online learning?
Yes, within my department, it seems, especially following last semester, which was our first full semester online, that there was a united effort amongst all of them in the department to give a more understanding and quality learning experience for us all. One of my professors, our class is asynchronous, so she provides videos a week ahead of time and allows us to digest the information within those videos, write down questions, and we hold a Zoom session at the end of the week to clarify any questions we may have on the material. Another one of my professors is very friendly and continues to strike conversation with the students to make them not feel alone, whether they be at home, living on campus, or attending in-person classes when available.
Do you think in the future, both while you continue undergrad and possibly when you go for your graduate degree, do you think that you're more likely to stay online or take hybrid classes or just strictly be in person?
Once the pandemic is over, I feel I would definitely want to increase my in-person time. But depending on my personal schedule, I may be inclined to take maybe one or two online courses since I've now had some experience with it.
In the broader spectrum, how do you personally believe UAlbany should better assist fully online students?
I think the university should set up some form of communication between fully online students and their instructors, or the university itself, in which either weekly, bi-weekly, or of that nature, students will be asked how they believe their teaching is going and how they believe their academic performance is doing. Professors can read what their online students say and adapt their learning or teaching style, as well as to possibly have more one-on-one interactions with the students outside of Zoom courses. I also think the university should take the students' point of view more seriously and fully understand the hardships and problems that they may be facing at home outside of just their own academic life.
And that was Alex Wyrick speaking with UAlbany student Sean McGarity about the challenges of learning during the COVID epidemic.
257 organizations signed a letter to Congress with recommendations to address plastic pollution and environmental justice in petrochemical corridors. For more, we go to HMM's Alexis Goldsmith.
This is Alexis Goldsmith for WOOC News. Recently, the Break Free from Plastic Coalition sent a letter to Congress outlining stimulus recommendations to address plastic pollution and environmental justice, and that was signed by 257 groups. To discuss more, we're joined by Casey Camp Horanek, Matriarch and Environmental Ambassador for the Ponca Tribe in Oklahoma. Welcome to the show, Casey.
Thank you, Alexis. I appreciate being here.
Could you please tell our listeners about who you are and a bit about your tribe?
Sure, I'd be happy to. My name, again, that's my colonized name, Casey Camp Horanek. I'm an elder of the Ponca Nation here in Oklahoma. I serve as the environmental ambassador. I'm also the traditional drum keeper for the Women's Society of our nation. I'm a mother, a grandmother, great-grandmother, a companion of over 50 years, and my husband and I have four incredible, we call them children, but they're adults. And we have in our nation here a situation of environmental devastation that is part of the fossil fuels destruction of our Mother Earth, and it is impacting our culture in every way, our health, our ability to be able to bring economic development to our people in any kind of healthy way. We can't grow organic food. We have an overload of children being, it seems like, born with asthma, at least in the first months and years of their lives, being hospitalized. Children are not even surprised when they see other children carrying an inhaler. It's the norm here. Our people have high rates of diabetes because of our forced removal from our original homelands and being imprisoned on a reservation here for the first 50 years of our existence in Oklahoma. And we have a multitude of polluters. ConocoPhillips, now Phillips 66, has a huge tank battery here that was largest in the United States till the 1990s. Underground storage facilities that stores gases from the World War II era. Spider webs of pipelines underneath us dating back 100 years and totally fragile, and it is creating a real sense of havoc for us and fear constantly, because we also have to deal with fracking and injection wells. And those have created over 10,000 earthquakes in the last 10 years, man-made earthquakes up to a 5.8 that are very shallow right where the pipelines are. The water is poisoned. The air is poisoned. Our bodies are poisoned. And so to work with a break free from plastics is a kind of a natural progression from the kind of environmental work that we've always been doing. Well, when I say always, I would say since the 1980s. And that starts another segment of my story, but we'll stop there.
I'd love to hear more about your environmental work, but first, can you tell us what was included that you recommended in the letter to Congress to address plastic pollution and environmental justice?
I want to say that Break Free from Plastic had a very comprehensive look at the plastic situation before I was ever involved. And the young people who are working with the Congress people who are also presenting this bill had very, very much tied together everything except this one issue that we struggle with here, and that is helping humans to connect the dots between petroleum and plastics. You know, we have had some very minor beginning steps by the Biden-Harris administration with stopping Keystone XL. Everyone looks at that as a great victory, and in many ways, it's long overdue to have any victories to talk about. But it has very little to do with the 99.99 that is still in practice here. You know, we have fracking here to such a degree that those little plastic pellets actually get into our wells and our streams and our rivers, and they're poisoning not just human life, but all life, the deer, the fish, everything that drinks water, and all living things do are dealing with these little plastic pellets. So my main, I feel, contribution to asking for help for us in terms of environmental justice. And I really want to stress that words also mean a lot. We live in an area of environmental injustice. We live in an area of environmental genocide. And so to be able to have some kind of build back better program in our territory would include helping people to have the educational facilities, or rather faculties, the ability to get printed word out there, to have meetings and to actually demonstrate to everyone why plastics as part of the petroleum chain are something that we have to become culturally aware of as part of our love and care for our Mother the Earth, our Father the Sky.
So aside from education and spaces for education on connecting plastics to petrochemicals, what does your tribe need to address the environmental injustice that you've suffered?
It's hard to even put it into words, you know. Ideally, it would be to be able to be restored to our homelands in Nebraska, which is now called Nebraska, South Dakota area, where the air, water, and earth is still clean. I don't think that even if we became a Superfund site here, that it would make a difference. But if we were trying to be able to say, what could we do today? We could look at the Ponca Nation as a poster child for the need for renewable energies, to say, how do we transition away? How do we do a just transition away from petroleum and plastics? Well, let the Poncas show you. In this manner, we would put out solar panels. We would have wind energy. We would have the statute that is already in place that we've created called the Rights of Nature. Those would be honored. And if we had to take it to a court of law, which we can do within our own tribal jurisdiction, but there's many loopholes there, then we would have other people saying we have to honor those rights of nature, all nature of which humans are part of, not separate from, have a right to live. And so let's transition away from plastic. How do we get water here for the Ponca people? That is water that has not been chemically treated, fracking through the loopholes that were created, can carry itself. The fracked water is injected into the earth here and shows up in our wells. Nothing we can do about that. ConocoPhillips dumps its waste into these little ditches which run into the streams, which run into the rivers that are on each side of us. So I guess number one would be to raise that awareness of the injustice that we deal with. Number two would be for the Biden-Harris administration to make a clear, concerted effort in their Build Back Better program to look at the indigenous peoples as a source of wisdom. We still understand how all things are related in terms of just human beings, and if you eat, drink, or breathe, how you're part of nature, not separate from. And in doing so, we start moving towards renewable energies in a quick way, because we're on the brink of extinction as a species.
That was Casey Camp Horenick of the Ponca tribe in Oklahoma, talking with Alexis Goldsmith about why Congress should address plastic pollution and environmental justice in the next stimulus bill. That was part one. Part two, you can also check out on MediaCentral.org on our podcast. That concludes your show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Mark Dunley.
And I'm Andrea Cutliffe. Our engineer tonight is Sina. Remember to tune in every weekday to get your daily dose of local news. You can also get that dose on demand through our Hudson Mohawk Magazine podcast and Facebook page. If you have comments or suggestions, then email us at hmm@HudsonMohawkMagazine. That's hmm@MediaSanctuary.org.
The Hudson Mohawk Magazine is produced by local volunteers. If you want to help, shoot us an email at info@MediaSanctuary.org. You can join our weekly virtual Zoom meetings Monday night, 7:07 p.m. by sending an email to hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thanks for tuning in.